This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael K. Williams, has co-starred in two great HBO crime series, and now he's in a third. In The Wire, he was Omar, the fearless stick-up man who stole money from drug dealers. In Boardwalk Empire, he was Chalky White, a bootlegger who runs a nightclub in Atlantic City. In the new HBO series, The Night Of, he plays an inmate in Rikers Island, the notorious jail in New York City. The series, created by Steve Zalian and Richard Price, is about a young man, Nassim, or Nas, who makes a mistake of judgment and finds himself accused of murder and trapped in the criminal justice system. Nas is a college student living in Queens, New York, with his parents, who are immigrants from Pakistan. Nas's father is a taxi driver. One night when Nas wants to go to a party, he takes his father's cab without permission. A woman gets into the taxi in spite of Nas's protests that he's not on duty. He ends up going home with her, and when he wakes up in a drug stupor, he finds she's been stabbed to death. He seems to have no idea what happened, and neither do we. But the evidence appears to be stacked against him, and neither he nor his parents know how to navigate within the judicial system. Bail is denied, and he's sent to Rikers Island, where his prison block is controlled by an inmate named Freddie, played by Michael K. Williams. Freddie takes an interest in Nas and summons him to his cell.
You see, us and the guards, we all from the same hood. Some of us even grew up together. They know our families, we know theirs. Well, family's everything, right? It isn't a Muslim family.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something, man. See those brothers you pray with, the Nation of Islam? They're not your friends. In fact, they hate your ass because you're a natural-born Muslim. And they're just phony jailhouse opportunists looking for better food. Don't know the difference between Cairo, Egypt, or Cairo, Illinois.
I'm Pakistani, not Egyptian.
Yeah, well, my ancestors came from Doheny and not the Congo. Who gives a man? See, so you're a celebrity in here. And I'm not talking a good kind. Dude kills four guys over some dope. Okay. But murder a girl? Rape a girl?
I didn't.
Doesn't matter. Makes no difference. See, there's a whole separate judicial system in here. And you've just been judged and juried. And it didn't come out good for you.
Michael K. Williams, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I really like your performance in this series. What did you want to know about your character when you took the role?
You know, when I first got the part, it wasn't really nothing I wanted to know about him. I'm so familiar with people like Freddie, you know, from my childhood and from my personal life. You know, I have family members that remind me of Freddie. You know, just all this potential, all this raw potential that just got misguided and led to bad decisions, and those bad decisions came with consequences. You know, I know that all too well, and so it wasn't something where I needed to do research to understand that world. You know, I still visit my family that's incarcerated, and I see the good days, I see the bad days, I see the growth, I see what they lost by being incarcerated, and I saw the gains. So I just dove into that.
You have family who's in jail now?
Yes, I have a nephew, Dominic DuPont, who I'm extremely proud of. He, if there were a such term as a model prisoner, he'd be the poster boy. You know, he went in at a very early age. He defended his twin brother in a fight, and they got jumped, and a gun went off, and someone lost their life at the hands of my nephew. And I believe that had we had the proper money to buy or to hire the high-powered lawyers, his outcome probably would have been different, I believe. But, you know, as it is, I believe he got railroaded. Did he do the crime? Yes. Did he do the time? Absolutely. But his record, what he's shown society, how he's grown in there. We're talking got his education, got married in there, managed to find a good woman and got married in there. He mentors young men that comes in behind him, whether it's a HIV/AIDS program or a Scared Straight program. While doing all of this, he still managed to keep his respect and his dignity. And as we all know, that's not easy to do in prison. You either you got to fight for your respect or you get run over. And he was able to ride that thin line.
So your character is in jail in Rikers Island, which is a very notorious jail in New York City. Did you know people in Rikers Island when you were growing up? Did you hear a lot of Rikers Island stories when you were growing up?
Yeah, D-Block, yeah, House of Pain, a Four Main House of Pain. You know, and I just want to take a moment to just say, to give a shout out to all my brothers and sisters who maybe incarcerated on the island from New York City. Just keep your head up, man, and just keep striving to be the best you could be. You know, they can lock your body up, but they can't lock your mind up. You know, just keep striving. Tomorrow's a better day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael K. Williams, and he's now one of the stars of the new HBO series, The Night Of. He starred in Boardwalk Empire as Chucky White. In The Wire, he was Omar. And now you have a new series on Viceland TV. That's the new Vice channel. And it's called Black Market. And this is where you go and report on underground markets, on black markets. And the first episode is about carjacking in Newark, New Jersey.
Yes, ma'am.
As part of your Viceland episode, you interview a minister, Reverend Ronald Christian, who ran the Christian Love Baptist Church, a church that bordered Newark in Irvington, New Jersey. And this was a church that was really important to you during a difficult period of your life. The episode is dedicated to the memory of this reverend. So in between the time that you recorded the interview and last November when he actually died, I don't know how much time elapsed, but you must have been really shocked. He was found dead on the floor of the church. Does anyone know what happened?
His heart just gave out, man. He got tired. You know, this was a man that I've never seen someone give so much of themselves, 100% night and day. He just never stopped. He was always there, you know, in the community. If you're familiar with Essex County, and particularly Irvington and, you know, certain parts of the Oranges and especially Newark, you know that there's a lot of violence that goes on there, a lot of death. Life is very cheap on those streets. And he was always there, every family, you know, and...
What did he do for you? You came to him during a difficult part of your life.
When I came around, I came through those doors, I was broken.
When was this?
This was around the second, more like third season of The Wire. I was you know, on drugs, basically, keeping it, you know, long story short. And I was in jeopardy of destroying everything that I had worked so hard for. And I came in those doors and I met a man who had never even heard of The Wire, much less watched it. He was somewhere else in the Bronx preaching at another church when I first went there, and he stopped everything he was doing, ran back to New Jersey just because his team at the church told him that some guy named Omar was in trouble and needed to speak to him. And he came in his office and he says, write your full name down and your email. He said, I'm gonna go get you a Bible, man. You could keep that and we're gonna spend the rest of this day. And I was like, bet. So I wrote my full name down, Michael Kenneth Williams. And as he's leaving the office, he turns around and says, So what you want to be called, man? I said, well, you know, my name is Michael, but, you know, I could do Mike, you know. He said, but why everybody saying Omar in trouble? And I was like, oh, this dude, that clueless. And, you know, had nothing to do with Hollywood light or who I was in my job. Some human being, just basic human being stuff. And he and I have been joined at the hip ever since. And He one of his biggest sayings was, I'm gonna love you till you learn to love yourself, you know, and he never judged, he never, you know, just nudged, you know, Mike, you know, if you want to stop this pain, I can help you with this, but until you're ready, man, I'm your brother. He never, you know, I'm not saying he accepted me in my dysfunctionalism, but he loved me in it, You know, he loved me in it, and there's a difference, there's a fine line, there's a huge difference with that, and it worked. It worked for me. It got me to want to become a grown man, to grow up and to stop acting foolish, or at least to make the attempt to stop acting foolish, you know.
Well, he had troubles in his own life. He had been a guard at a prison in New Jersey, in Newark, and then he started using drugs, and he ended up having to serve time in prison for stealing from the prison
that he was working at. Talk about fall from grace, huh, T?
yeah. And he tells you in the episode that he learned to drive on a carjacked car. So he knew something about the kinds of problems people came to him with, because he had problems of his own. Did that help you, knowing that he had transformed his life? Was that like helpful as an example?
That was a huge help to me, you know, into not beating myself up so badly. Not it helped me to let go of the guilt and the shame of, you know, what I had done out there, what I was doing out there, you know, and just that, seeing him and to have him as an example of what it could be, it definitely made my transition a lot smoother. He gave me a template, you know, basically, like, okay, you know. And I'm not saying, I don't want to sound like I'm putting him up on a pedestal, you know, but it, you know, his message and the way he delivered the word, it was about no judgment. It was about the sin is not falling down. The sin is staying on the ground. You got to pick yourself up. We're going to make mistakes. We've made mistakes. There's going to be a few more we make before this ride is over. You make your apologies to whoever you may have, you know, and then you try to pick yourself up, take it one day at a time. And that was his message.
So he went from prison guard to prisoner to reverend. So I assume there was some kind of like religious transformation along the way. Was there a religious transformation in your life? Did that figure into your life at all?
Yeah, it was more of a spiritual awakening than anything religious. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the first time I actually walked into a church and felt like it's okay. I didn't feel dirty. You know, I come from there's a lot of things in my past, some that I did, some that happened to me that you know, caused, you know, a lot of scars. You know, one was, you know, the molestation that went on in my life early on. I'm a survivor of that.
How old were you?
12 or 13, 12, somewhere up in there. You know, things happen.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you move on, and I never would go into church. I always felt like, you know, with the whole, it made me question myself on every level. You know, those events happening so early on in my life. And I would go to church with this, like, you know, this secret, this weight, like, I'm dirty. I'm dirty. God is never going to want me. I'm dirty, you know. You mix that with the whole, you know, dark skin just became popular. I had a very low self-esteem coming up, and I just never felt like God loved me because I was dirty, because, you know, I was damaged goods for whatever reasons, whatever that means, you know. And I wore that badge very early on in my life, and I didn't let that go until I walked into Christian Love Baptist Church. You know, I saw other men who said, yeah, me too, out loud. And it doesn't make you less of a man. It doesn't make you dirty. You know, how to forgive myself and how to forgive people, move on. I got all of that in Christian Love.
Can I just ask, you know, when you were playing Omar on The Wire, Omar was gay. And I know that was challenging for you because you knew a lot of people who would be uncomfortable about you playing a gay man. And I think it was a little bit, you felt it was a little bit of a stretch too, but you did it. You did it excellently. You were the person who suggested the kiss when Omar first kisses his boyfriend on camera. You said, like, let's do it now. So you basically wrote that in. But when you were 12 and you were molested, did that make you like question what your sexual orientation was? Like, what did that mean? And did that make you, do you know what I mean? Did that make you unsure of yourself in ways that made you?
It definitely made me question, you know, why me, you know. So that type of stuff can, you know, mess with my head a little bit. You know, just those things you just did not talk about. You didn't talk about anything that made you feel sensitive or vulnerable. Those were not good character traits to have in my community. So here comes Omar, and he is so external. He doesn't hide who he is. He is like the quintessential underdog in, you know, in all senses of the word in my community. He's a dark-skinned, openly gay black man who's not effeminate, who, you know, walks around openly with his boyfriend, doesn't care about fancy clothes, jewelry, doesn't use drugs, doesn't sell drugs, doesn't want to live in any fancy home. He just, anything that was deemed as eye candy in my community, you know, he rebuked all of that and was still deemed as respectable. You respected him, and you know, and that was like, just, how do you do that? How do you make people respect you for being you in my community? How do you not conform to what society has made men in my community deem as being a man? You know, just this external thing. How did you get past? How did you make it cool to just be yourself in an oppressed situation, in an oppressed community? How do you do that? And it was just mind-boggling for me.
You know, in our first interview, you talked about how when you were playing Omar, it was hard for you to summon up the kind of power that he had. I mean, he was a stick-up man. He used to hold up drug dealers and steal their money. He didn't approve of drugs. He didn't like dealers. So he'd take their money and have no qualms about it. And he was tough enough and brave enough to do it. So you said that you never thought of yourself as having that kind of power. You know, in fact, the opposite. And so the thought of you playing that role made you laugh. And you even told me that in the first scenes that you played, you couldn't stop laughing because you thought it was so absurd for you to be playing somebody with that kind of power. So
it was the scene when we was walking down the aisle, and Omar coming to drop the drugs out the window. He turns his back. I'm like, no one in their right mind who knows me. I said, it's over now. We're going to ruin this character because people are going to go out there. They're going to say, that's not real. We know Mike. Mike is not that. And it was like, you know. And so for me to connect, you know, again, the whole alpha male aspect, I
feel like maybe I understand a little bit more what you were saying. Like, if you were molested, I could understand how you would feel like you didn't have that kind of physical power.
Yeah, I never felt like that. And you know, I just wasn't raised to be, you know, to have that violent side. So it kind of,
or to be physically intimidating.
Yeah.
You're laughing.
I don't have that.
Yeah, right.
I don't have that. You know, I wasn't raised in my household it wasn't accepted in my mom's household to fight. That just was not the case, and mm-hmm. and so I just didn't have that skill. But the anger, the emotions, I didn't know what to do with those when people would, you know, create those emotions in me. What do I do with that? So as a result, I ended up hurting myself a lot. A lot of my anger was turned inward on me, and that's where the drug addiction came from, basically.
So why do you think you started using drugs started using them again? I'm not sure which. After The Wire was on, after you'd become successful, because you'd think on the surface that would be a period when your self-esteem would be like really good because you were so great in the role and people like loved you in it.
Yeah, see, that's the trick. It can't be anything outward that makes you feel good about yourself. That is the trick. Those things don't work. Feeling good, that's got to come from the inside out, not the outside in. And, you know,
Or you didn't feel worthy?
No, hell no, I didn't feel worthy of opportunity like that. And then, you know, when I was given this character as Omar, I could have used it as a tool of, you know, as a nurturing tool for myself. It could have been cathartic for me. I decided to wear it as a Spider-Man suit, you know, and just fly around. Wee, look at me, I got web in my hands, you know. And instead of actually doing the work and finding out how I could, you know, use this character to make myself feel better about me, I used it instead of me. It was, I you know, like, it was like my crutch. And so when Omar and the Wire, when The Wire and the character of Omar ended, I had zero tools, you know, personally speaking, in how to deal with letting that go. I wasn't going around robbing people or anything stupid like that, but I definitely wore that dark energy that Omar was. He was a dark soul, tortured soul, and I just woke all of that up and lived in that. And that's what people was attracted to. His whatever they were attracted to, I just didn't know how to differentiate. Okay, that is Omar's love, and then you have Michael's love. You know, the lines got blurred. It was a little too close to the white meat at the time. It's a little figure of speech in the streets. okay. When you cut somebody to the white meat, it was a little too close to home, that character, and I didn't equip myself with the tools of how to wash that off my psyche.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, when you started on The Wire, you weren't very experienced as an actor. You'd had small roles, including a small role on The Sopranos. You'd been in videos, but you hadn't had a major part like that, and, you know, a recurring part in a major series. But by the time you did Boardwalk Empire, you were much more experienced, and now you've just done The Night Of, and you're even more experienced. So what are some of the ways your approach to acting has changed between The Wire and now, when you're such a more experienced actor?
Well, one of the main things that's changed from when I was first on The Wire and to now, and particularly The Night Of, is I know how to differentiate myself from the character. You know, I still go in just as deep, but now I have the tools, which was not the case during The Wire days. I had the tools in which how to pull myself out of that. You know, I had the tools, and it starts, number one, with meditation, prayer and meditation. You know, you got to wash that off your psyche. You got to wash your brain, man. You got to cleanse yourself internally. You know, for me, you know, when I wear these characters to the extent that I wear them to, you got to, like, that's got to go somewhere. That's energy, man. You got to put that somewhere when you're done with it. You can't just leave it lingering, you know.
When you say prayer, what does prayer mean to you? What do you do when you pray, can I ask?
Of course. It's just a good old-fashioned, I get on my knees and I get real grateful. I get real grateful, number one. I thank the universe, God, whatever you want to call him, man. Mm-hmm. I get grateful for the opportunity to bring light and life to a story, because all my stories are real. You know, all my characters are based in reality, whether the character itself may be fiction, but the situation and the emotions that come from it, those situations, those are real situations. I don't play fictional characters in that sense, you know, where, you know, you can't look hard enough and fight. There's never been a character that I haven't played where someone says, I know a guy just like that. So that's my lane. And so I honor that. I give thanks to the chance to be given the opportunity to tell someone's story and to have someone feel like they give someone something to identify with. I take pride in that, and I take gratitude in that. So that begins the process to let me remind myself, Mike, it's not about you. You know, you've been given a job. You have a vessel in which you get to touch people through your art. That's a blessing, you know, and it's, you know, I'm very humble to be living this life and to have this job, but I have to protect myself. I got to take care of my vessel, and it's a spiritual, mental, and physical thing constantly.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for all the great work you've done.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for your time.
Michael K. Williams co-stars in the new HBO series, The Night Of, and he hosts the new Viceland series, Black Market. Our critic at large, John Powers, says these are boom times for dystopian fiction. The trend takes a feminist spin in The Natural Way of Things, a new novel by Charlotte Wood, recently released by Europa Editions. The book won several major literary prizes in her native Australia, and John says it deserved to because it's a rarity, a page-turner that captures real truths about the dark side of contemporary life.
Novelists have always put their heroines through awful ordeals. But over time, these tribulations change. Where the 19th century was filled with fictional women trapped in punishing marriages, think of Middlemarch or The Portrait of a Lady, today's heroines face trials that are bigger, more political, and more physically demanding. They fight in Hunger Games. This fight takes a different form in the natural way of things. A ferocious new novel by the Australian Charlotte Wood, whose writing recalls the early Elena Ferrante. It's tough, direct, and makes no attempt to be ingratiating. Set in a dystopian backwater, her short, gripping book begins as an allegory of thuggish misogyny, then evolves into a far stranger and more challenging feminist parable. The first chapters plunge us into a dusty, desolate prison camp deep in the outback. The prisoners, we learn, are 10 young women whose crime, so to speak, is to have been involved in sex scandals, from sleeping with a priest to engaging in a cruise ship orgy to giving sexual favors to the judge of a talent show. Now pariahs, they've been drugged and kidnapped, dressed in rough, ratty clothes, and sent off to do hard, pointless labor. Surrounded by electric fencing and cackled at by the kookaburras, they are being systematically degraded. With such a setup, Wood is clearly offering a metaphor for our own everyday world, in which girls are slut-shamed, rape victims get accused of bringing the violence on themselves, female celebrities are threatened sexually online, and at the outer limit, women are actually murdered in the name of honor, as recently happened to the Pakistani social media star Kandel Baloch, who was killed by her brother for dishonoring her family. All these cases remind us that female sexuality, and the bullying attempt to control it, remain dangerously volatile flashpoints in almost every culture. What keeps all this from seeming doctrinaire is the book's sheer imaginative intensity. Woods's writing crackles with vivid precision. From her accounts of the prisoners' disgusting meals, you can almost taste the powdery mac and cheese in water, to her strikingly exact descriptions of nature. When kangaroos begin magically bounding by the hundreds through the camp, she registers not only the thumping syncopation, but also notices their little, malleted, dark faces. Of course, like any really good captivity story, the natural way of things is also about ways of escape. In particular, Wood focuses on two very different heroines who form a strange, almost silent bond as survivors. One is Yolanda, a ravishing, physically strong 19-year-old whom I kept picturing as a marvelous otherworldly creature, like Charlize Theron in Mad Max. The other is the brainy Verla, who's clearly the educated reader's surrogate. She was the lover of a married political bigshot, and because of her higher social status, Verla initially thinks that she, unlike the others, is there by mistake. Where their fellow captives spend their free time yearning for their old clothes and trying to make themselves attractive, one even starts sleeping with a guard, Yolanda and Verla explore the campgrounds around them. Wandering the barren landscape that comes to life after a new rainfall, Yolanda turns herself into a hunter who traps wild rabbits, and in the process grows ever more feral herself. Verla obsessively throws herself into looking for mushrooms, for reasons that soon become apparent. Both wind up being transformed. And here's where the book's title comes in. Where the male captors think it the natural way of things that men should rule, Yolanda and Verla strip away the historical veneer of female subservience. They recreate themselves based on a deeper, more complicated vision of the natural order, one that grasps the bond between all living things. I'd like to tell you that this is a happy ending, but Wood is too honest to offer anything so reassuringly simple. Even as her heroines find a radical new approach to living, Wood knows that the natural way of things is as risky and wild as it is free.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed The Natural Way of Things by Charlotte Wood. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My next guest is soul singer Sharon Jones. Her music is inspired by the classic soul and R&B she grew up with, by performers like James Brown and Aretha Franklin. She's backed by the horns, guitar, and rhythm section of the band The Dap Kings, which also backed Amy Winehouse on her album Back to Black. Sharon Jones and The Dap Kings are known for their showmanship, reminiscent of 60s soul revues. Jones is a powerhouse. But in 2013, she was diagnosed with stage 2 pancreatic cancer, had extensive surgery, and months of chemo. After finishing chemo, recovering from the surgery, and getting clean scans, she returned to the stage and did a world tour with the Dap Kings. But then the cancer returned. The new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, is about the first 7 months after her initial diagnosis. The film was directed by Barbara Koppel, who won Oscars for her documentaries Harlan County, USA, An American Dream. Let's start with a song from the soundtrack of the new film, a recording that was also used in a Fitbit commercial. This is 100 Days, 100 Nights. Sharon Jones, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the new movie. Can I start by asking you how your health is now?
Well, I had chemo yesterday. The doctors took me off of one chemo medicine, the one that's causing a neuropathy. I told them I didn't want to take that anymore because it's really causing more pain and stuff in my legs and causing a problem. But today is one of my best days. You know, I'm on and off. I take it one day at a time. And being on the stage with them, performing and opening up, for Hall & Oates for the last 2.5 weeks. And then doing 3 nights in a row, 1 day off, three. So I did like 9 straight nights and a day off in between there. So, but I feel pretty good.
That is an insane schedule when you're in chemo. That's just insane.
But that's my therapy, being on stage. It's like this cancer is here. And I'm gonna have to take the chemo, but I want to perform. I don't want to be home just taking medicine and waiting to die. So as long as I got my health and the energy, my voice is great. So there's nothing wrong vocally. I just want to be able to get on stage and move around.
So making a documentary about you after you were diagnosed with cancer in 2013, that was the idea of your manager, Alex. What did you initially think of the idea? And forgive me for asking something so straightforwardly.
Excuse me.
But if I were you, I probably wouldn't know whether this was going to end up as an obituary or a triumphant return to the stage.
Yeah. Well, I think once Barbara Coppola took it on and the band, my goal was to... I had a February date, and my goal was to be back at that date. And everything in the filming and there's a scene with the church scene. That was my first time even attempt to sing after months. And that's when I knew from the church scene that I was ready. I was going to be ready for February. I knew I was going to have the strength, my faith and my belief and in myself. I knew I was ready to go back out. And I knew that sickness wasn't under to death. After I thought I was going to die maybe a couple of hours, after the doctor hit me with everything. You go through that. So for a couple of hours, I was on my deathbed. But other than that, I overcame that. And doing the film was also my therapy. And I knew that it would help someone out there with cancer or going through it, as long as I inspired someone, because I was... That's where my health came from. My energy came from knowing my fans was out there and I'm getting back to them, and I wanted them to see me go what I'm going through with.
The impression I take away from the film is that you had a great feeling of responsibility for the band, because the band is centered around you. There's horns and drummer and, guitarist and everything, but you're the singer, you're the focal point. So if you're not there, the band's kind of out of work. And
it's not only the band, it's the whole, my whole, I mean, management, my whole, you know, we got
punches.
We got, it's so much, you know, it's a whole big, we got an LLC, we got, it's a company here.
Mm-hmm.
And so with a lot of people not getting paid, including myself, and one of the doctors wasn't included in insurance, so we had to pay out of the pocket money for, you know, so it was, and believe it or not, I didn't know what was going on with all of my members. Thank God they kept that away from me.
Wait, that, what didn't you know about?
Like Binky going through the divorce and then, you know, losing
your,
stuff. And like
guitarist.
Gabe not being,
yeah.
mm-hmm. not being able to get the loan, and just different people in the band, you know, lost apartments and, you know, had to move in. So it was a lot that they didn't put that on me, you know, but I found out about it later.
There's a scene in the documentary Miss Sharon Jones when you go to a church in Queens, New York,
mm-hmm.
and you sing His Eye Is on the Sparrow. And it's a really nice scene. I thought we could listen to you singing that. And this is, as you said, this is the first time that you sang after getting the surgery and starting chemo. So why don't we hear that?
Okay.
And then we'll talk.
Again, I just want to give honor to God. And right now I'm going to try to sing a little bit of His Eyes on a Sparrow. And I sing because I'm happy. And I sing because I'm free.
You were not holding back.
No, I was letting it all out, and I was, you know, and it's, that's a difference. And anointing came over me. I just opened my mouth, and they just come out, you know, and the air just flowed, and that was, like I said, from that thing, I knew that God had watched over me, and He had me ready. I was gonna be ready for February.
Why did you choose that song to be the first song and to be the song that you sang in this small neighborhood church?
Because if He watches over a little sparrow, you know, if He take care of the birds, a little sparrow, here I am, one of His children, you know. We got so many of us down here. If He watch over a sparrow, I know He watches over me. And that was the song. And it was about I'm singing, you know, because I'm happy and I'm free. When I get in church and I sing, and I mean, singing is my life. And when I can do that, that's when I'm free. That's when I'm at my happiest, I'm at my most.
What was the importance of the church in your early singing life?
I think it just prepared me for what to come out here. I mean, it prepared me for when I was told I didn't have what it took, which I knew I was a singer. But they was looking for looks and style and...
Right, you were told you were too short and too black.
Too
and
fat, yeah,
too fat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I didn't make it there with, you know, when I was in that youth in my late 20s, 30s, and 40 was my first album I got a chance to record. And the reason why I got a chance to record that, because we built our record label and started Daptone, and then they finally got a label so I can have an album out, Dap Dipping, and... We don't have to worry about if I sold 5,000 or 500. The record label wasn't gonna fold under or fire me because I didn't sell, you know, a million records or whatever.
Since we just heard you sing in church, tell us about the early churches that you sang in when you were a girl.
One of my churches was in the South, South Carolina, right across the bridge from Augusta, Georgia. But that was the church my first time ever attempting to sing for the Nativity Christmas play. I played an angel, and I got to sing Silent Night, and I was like maybe 8-9 years old, and I remember, you know, doing that, and I was like, and those people, that little girl can sing, and I think right then and there I knew that I was going to be a singer. You know, God had blessed me with a gift to sing.
Did you sing in choirs or did you usually sing solo?
Well, at that time I was young. I just sang with my sister. My sister Willa, we used to sing a little duet like, take the love with you. Oh, and she'd take a verse and I'll take a verse. And you know, that's how I was just going from there. You know, and then later on in the church in New York, I started going to that church at 14 and I just direct the choirs. I never took any kind of vocal lessons or teachings of how to. I never even took piano lessons, and a voice just came to me and said, go play the piano in church. And I followed my bass player and my guitar player, and I just started playing piano with two fingers, and I just started playing my chords, and that's where I'm at. And listening to Aretha, who was my biggest inspiration, and when I saw her on the Amazing Grace album, and she had that daishiki on, and she did this song, Mary, Don't You Weep, and that was one of the songs, I said, I'm going to play this piano.
In the documentary, you say that you feel like a different person than you were before you got sick, and that when you started performing again, you basically wanted to figure out who you were. Who was this new Sharon Jones, and who was this new Sharon Jones going to be on stage? So do you feel like you've been able to answer that for yourself as a performer?
Yeah, the night I went out there, it was like, it was a different Sharon because the hair is gone. I mean, everyone said my energy was great, but I didn't feel it all. Like Binky always said, 110 pounds of soul. I felt like that night, maybe I gave like 90 of it or, you know, a little less. And even now, the days on the stage, I'm just not myself. I don't have that energy. And the legs doesn't lift up like I want to with the pain. The neuropathy from certain chemo is like, it's a hinder. But I do the shows, but it's not the same.
Right. Because you, for anybody who hasn't seen you perform, you do a lot of dancing and jumping around on stage. You are not still. So I could see how it would be very difficult to do that with neuropathy.
Yeah. It's some nights it's tough, like I said, and to get past that pain and you know, and each night it seems like once Binky said, Miss Sharon Jones, and I walk out there, all the nerves gone, all the nervousness and the pain, you know, I fight through it. You know, those first couple of seconds or the first 5 minutes, it's, you know, is the most that I can get through it.
I have to say, though, there's a point in the movie where you say, if it comes to a point where you have to sing while sitting in a chair or on a stool, that's when you're going to retire. And I thought, that's ridiculous. I mean, there's so many singers I love, like jazz singers, who spent so much of their career just sitting in a chair or sitting on a stool singing. And, like, that was great for me. I mean, I love your voice. Like, why wouldn't you just sing sitting down if you needed to?
Well, I guess I'm going to have to if something like that happened the way you just went. Like, okay.
I mean, really, like, don't retire if you end up having to sit down and sing.
Maybe then I'll hire some dancers to come out and start dancing around the stage.
Fine. We were talking about returning to performing after the surgery and the chemo and figuring out, like, who is Sharon Jones now that you've gone through all of that. And it seems to me like you're trying to be this, like, powerhouse on stage, but allowing yourself to be just a little vulnerable on stage. Like, when you first return at the comeback concert at the Beacon Theater in New York, you still have a little bit of chemo brain, and you're worried you're going to forget the lyrics. Oh. And you do on the first song. You blank on a couple of words.
First couple, yeah.
Yeah, and you explain it to the audience. You tell the audience what's happening. They're totally with you. But yeah. I bet being even like the least bit vulnerable on stage was something kind of new to you.
It was new to me, and that's why I take the time. I have to talk about it, because if I don't talk about it, it'll hold me back, and I won't concentrate. I'll be concentrating on that, you know, of what's going on. And I, even now when I get on the stage, I tell the people what my day, you know, it's tough back here. I've been sitting back, you know, I've been in pain, but I get through it, you know, and I let them know that, you know, I'm not wearing my little fancy dancy heels anymore. I got to wear these shoes because they're comfortable, you know, just got to wear what's comfort, or I take them off when they're not. And once I tell the audience how I feel, I relax, the pain go away, or I can deal with it. Now I'm not thinking about it, and I'm just there to let the audience know, and they see that you know, that's my therapy. That works for me. So I talk about it and go ahead and do it.
So you said that when you're on stage, like, the pain is gone, you know, you are totally in the music. But do you have to pay a price for that, like, the day after?
Sometimes, or not even the day after. As soon as I get off the stage, I can go to the dressing room, and maybe another half an hour later, I can barely stand up. You know, I didn't stiffen up again, or, you know, sometimes. And then the other time, I'm like, whoa, I feel great today, you know. So, it's like I just keep saying that over again, one day at a time. Each day is a little different.
And the band understands.
Oh, the band, I learned certain things, even if I'm not, like, feeling like I'd be in a lot of pain. And if I tell them I'm in a really lot of pain and they see that in my face, it sort of gets them down, because all night they're watching me now, you know. And sometimes I might tell them I'm really, you know, a little pain. So Gabe would start off too slow or calling slow songs, and I look at him like, pick it up, you know. And so I've learned now, I'm like, no matter what, I'm going to throw look at them and flash a smile. I'm okay, guys. You know, I'm all right. Pain is pretty good. I don't feel that much pain. Even if I do feel a little bit more pain, I have to get that smile and let them know that pain is not that bad.
Sharon Jones, it's just been great to talk with you. I wish you good luck with your health and with the chemo, and I'm so glad you're still performing.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep on keeping on as long as I got my health and strength, and God give me that will to do it.
Sharon Jones is the subject of the new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross. I've been away too long. Our conversation has been few, but while I've been away, each and every day.